venture to say, and I'm disappointed in my own academy for not calling this out, that these are low-quality trials with severe methodological flaws. The point that I'm making here is that who in their right mind having severe fracture pain is going to make a flip of the coin decision on whether or not to participate in a trial like this? These trials, I admire them for trying to do these trials, but they're very difficult. And I think the same probably applies to the more recent trials. The trials that you want to look at for clinical evidence are trials that follow all patients that are either enrolled or not enrolled, and what happens to those, much like the sports trials that looked at disc herniations. And I know we were discussing science and anecdotal evidence in general, but the reality is if it doesn't pass the smell test, something's wrong. Fractures hurt. They're painful. And granted, some are less painful than others, and some have various stages in healing when they're diagnosed. But a 101-year-old grandfather of my nurse practitioner was misdiagnosed for whatever reason. He had severe pain. He had a relatively minor incident, and he was on opiates and was died nearly of a respiratory arrest until he was finally appropriately diagnosed and treated with a kyphoplasty. This was just last week. These are life-saving procedures in patients. So, and if the science is bad, we need to reject the bad science and move forward.
So, Dr. Coe, let me ask, related to the question on the table, how long would you ask require non-surgical management before proceeding to augmentation?
Very good. And the point I want to make, it depends on the patient and the clinical presentation. If a patient is in acute pain and can't move, has impairment of ADLs, very poor scores on ODI, or whatever clinical measures you use, you will treat them more urgently. If they present with relatively minor pain, they're more functional, then you can wait and try bracing and other measures. So it's a patient selection issue. Again, the point I made earlier, this is a heterogeneous population. And it's a variable thing, and I will offer this.
Although I would say I think most of the studies have at least been moderate to severe pain. They haven't included minor pain.
Well, I understand that. But pain is subjective, unfortunately, and what one patient perceives as severe pain is maybe more tolerated by others. And some folks will minimize their pain for various reasons, because they don't want to be a burden on their family.
So you're suggesting if they're reporting it as mild, that we should still consider them a potential candidate?
Well, not necessarily. It depends upon other factors. If a patient says their pain is mild, but they're stuck in bed and can't get up, so I'm not going to get out of bed, it hurts too much, but you know, my pain's only a 2 out of 10, I'm not necessarily going to believe them. If their ADLs are impaired and their fracture anatomy is appropriate, they have the appropriate imaging study. So this has to be handled on a case-by-case basis from the point of view of active clinical practice. But from the point of view of the science, we have to be very careful about not getting seduced by randomized controlled trials that are published in prestigious journals, because
we've covered the deficiencies. You don't necessarily need to go over that. But sticking to trying to
talk
about the length of non-surgical management, as I mentioned in the beginning, I think most of the Medicare policies require 6 to 12 weeks approximately after 6 to 12 weeks of non-surgical management. Clearly, there are some that you would do immediately. Is there would there be any that you would wait on six weeks or 12 weeks on?
If a patient was functional, if the patient responded to, let's say, bracing and non-opiate medication, they didn't have significant deformity, and I would say this is a reasonable option. This fracture will heal. If it fails to heal properly, in my case, I would perform kyphoplasty. Would be an alternative option. And I do. That's exactly how I clinically practice. It depends upon the acuity and the amount of impairment in the subacute and acute phase. Unfortunately, I see some hospitalized patients. A lot of those tend to go to my IR colleagues. Most of the patients I see are in the outpatient setting. And some of those patients are moderately impaired and some are less so. And I had one patient that was literally held captive recently in a skilled nursing home, totally misdiagnosed. She was sent off for pain management and held prisoner in a skilled nursing facility until I made the diagnosis of a compression fracture and treated her she escaped from there, signed up AMA, and I treated her, and she went home and was extraordinarily grateful for that. So there's a lot of misdiagnosis, unfortunately.
Thank you. Operator, if we could open the line to the next commenter.
And your next question is the line of Dr. Alan Brooke.
Hi. I spoke earlier. I want to reiterate what the orthopedic surgeon just said. The standard of care is usually when you find a weight-bearing fracture that presents. So most patients who have asymptomatic fractures in the spine, mostly in the thoracic because they're not weight-bearing, don't usually present to the emergency room or to the doctor's office with pain or disability. So there's no other bone in the body that's weight-bearing that doesn't get treated once they present. Now, treatment can be more conservative if the patient understands what the risks and benefits of the procedure are and they're able to move and go on with their daily activities, and they can deal with pain management with a non-narcotic type of pain medication. Those are reasonable. In addition, most times when a patient has a weight-bearing bone that's fractured, they treat it for not only the pain management and activity, but so it doesn't get deformed. I think it was the Virtus 4 trial or Virtus trial that showed that when a bone is augmented in the spine, it doesn't continue to fracture over time and get more deformity. And other trials have supported that as well. So there's more than one issue involved, not only the pain, and that should be treated just like any other standard of care in weight-bearing fractures when it presents, if clinically indicated, just like the speakers before said. And clearly, it will prevent further deformity. I think that's well documented in the literature. Thank you. Any questions?
Dr. Brooke, as far as the time of you know, the question at hand again, the length of non-surgical management. Do you have any views on that in particular?
Oh, absolutely. When patients present with a weight-bearing fracture that's painful or debilitating, every place in the body, whether your ankle, your knee, or your hip, you treat it when it presents, unless bracing it or standard NSAIDs or some other pain medication can have them go on with their daily care of life. So the sooner you treat it, the less deformity they'll have and the higher quality of life they'll have.
Would you ever wait 6 to 12 weeks?
If a patient presented incidentally and we saw the fracture because of imaging and it wasn't painful and it wasn't deforming them or stopping them from daily activities, I would advise them that this is the fracture you have. These are the methods we can treat it. But if you're doing your daily activities and it's not very painful, I could easily see waiting 6 weeks or following them closely and advising them that osteoporosis management is vitally important. Two, that physical therapy in a very controlled way is important. And three, is not to lift things that are heavy and advise them on how to grasp things like from the ground. So they need to be taught how to do their daily activities in a safer fashion.
But you wouldn't, if somebody had persistent, somebody had persistent moderate severe pain and it was still limiting them, you wouldn't just stick to an arbitrary length of 6 or 12 weeks.
Absolutely not. This is not a cookbook. We're not baking a cake. The patient and their family has a say in it, and they really need to understand what the risks and benefits are to both doing nothing and to treatment of what most weight-bearing fractures have. The standard of care is to treat them early to prevent deformity. Thank you.
Operator, next comment.
Your next question line of Dr. Stephen DePrima.
Good afternoon. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. CAC representative from Florida. I am an interventional neuroradiologist, and I have no conflicts of interest. Just a quick comment about the Virtus 4 study, which has been brought up a few times. While it was designed to be more robust, you know, I have a couple concerns with this methodology, and I was wondering if Dr. Hogg also shared my concerns. They included patients over 50 years old, and so the classic proxy for osteoporosis of older age. Number two, they treated more than one vertebral compression fracture if they saw them at the same sitting. And lastly, while they initially enrolled patients with pain up to 6 weeks, because of enrollment problems, they halfway through the study, they expanded that indication to pain up to 9 weeks. Does anybody else share those concerns with methodology?
I read that recent Clark paper that was published last week that mentioned that that because of delays, even though they were billed as acute, i.e. less than 6 weeks, in some cases they were 9 weeks or maybe even a little bit more. I forget the exact wording. So, yeah, that would be concerning. As far as the multiple fractures, I think that's I'm not positive on that, but I think they did 1 to 3, and I don't know that that's a real outlier. And obviously the age, I don't know what the average age is, but obviously we're talking about Medicare-eligible patients here. So
right,
the
and they took
care of
patients 50 years of age.
Yeah. Dr. Hirsch, do you have any comments on that, on those things?
Yes, I mean, I need to state a bias, which is that I'm an author of the Virtus 4 trial. I think, Dr. DePrima, you're raising concerns. I would caution that multiple levels is common in vertebral augmentation trials. Surrogates for osteoporosis go well beyond age, and there is no question that you are correct that the indications were expanded, perhaps inadvertently, but they were expanded beyond the 6 weeks. That critique by both yourself and Dr. Clark is correct.
And Dr. DePrima, do you, again, I have to go back to the question, as far as the length of non-surgical management, currently the standard in Medicare is more like 6 to 12 weeks before proceeding to vertebroplasty. Do you have any feelings about what that length should be, if any?
Yes, I do. By personal experience, I would say that my treating of chronic compression fractures has not been particularly good with in terms of improvement post-procedure. But I would say that before I'd consider treating somebody 3 to 4 months out, they would have an MRI that showed persistent edema and physical findings consistent with that compression fracture, or in this day of age of pacemakers, a bone scan. There would have to be something additional imaging-wise, advanced imaging-wise, to help guide me that that could be still an active fracture as opposed to just a chronic fracture with normal bone marrow signal.
Thank you. Operator, next commenter.
And your next question in line of Dr. Mark Allison.
Hi there, this is Mark Allison from California. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, I'm a diagnostic radiologist in California. I'm a CAC member. I do not do these procedures. I just had a question based on something, Dr. Haug, that you were asking about on the periosteal injection of bupivacaine versus vertebroplasty. It would seem to me that an injection of an anesthetic, while it may or may not work, wouldn't be as durable. And has anyone looked at durability of that arm versus vertebroplasty?
Rod, the Virtus 4, what did that go out to, a year, Dr. Hirsch? I think it, at least as far as the follow-up in the Virtus 4, it was as durable. Am I right on that, Dr. Hirsch?
You're correct. Yep.
Was the follow-up there a year?
Yes.
Okay. But as far as, you know, it wearing off, one would think that the anesthetic would wear off way before a year.
So, yeah, that was my question.
Did you have any comment on the length of non-surgical management that it would be appropriate?
The only comment I would have, again, just from seeing patients anecdotally, again, I don't do these, but having had relatives that have had them and such, to me, I think what you heard from my colleague, the orthopod here in California, makes the most sense to me. I think you treat patients on a clinical basis. I think the timing is less important than the clinical presentation and how the patient's doing. That would seem to make sense, frankly, in all of medicine to me.
Although, again, the point was brought up that in general, with fractures, that we go to immobilize them right away, you know, in other areas of the body, let's say. I mean, there's definitely been a trend, especially against away from sort of the passive external fixation via cast, where you have to, the body or the limb is sort of has to be inactive for a period of time and more to immediate active internal fixation, which this would seem analogous to.
Yeah, which makes sense to me in an older osteoporotic patient, because if you limit them, if you cast them, if you make them non-weight-bearing, you're just going to lose more bone, which I think in someone of the ages that we tend to be talking about is a bad idea in general. So I would agree with that.
Okay. Because that was put out there as the question, why should this treatment of these types of fractures be treated differently than other types of fractures? But thank you for that comment. Operator, if we go to the next commenter.
Your next question line of Dr. Lance Ryan-Smith.
Dr. Ryan-Smith, before you proceed, I couldn't find you on our list that you submitted disclosure. Are you a CAC member?
Yeah, I'm a representative of the American College of Radiology.
Okay. I guess we didn't have you on our list of subject matter experts. But if you could send us a disclosure form then.
It was sent to, I think it got to Virginia,
okay,
to by Alicia
right.
Blakey. Was, but,
all right. Well, why don't you introduce yourself and tell us any conflict of interest you have.
Yeah, so I'm Lance Ryan-Smith. I'm an interventional radiologist, the musculoskeletal, in San Antonio, Texas. I work in private practice. I have no conflicts of interest. I perform these procedures almost daily. And so the question was about the time course. And when I read the literature, whether for studies that have a primary outcome favorable to percutaneous vertebroplasty or vertebral augmentation, you can look at virtus, where selection criteria is less than virtus 2 is less than 6 weeks. Rousing, which showed a benefit at 1 month, was selection criteria less than 8 weeks. The Faroki trial was some patients were at 4 weeks. The Vapor trial less than 6 weeks, and then the 2018 study by Yang published in Spine, that was less than 3 weeks. All of them showed primary outcomes favorable to vertebroplasty. So, and then there was a comment before about the UCLA RAND. If you look into it, where there's 7 different appropriateness variables, their duration of pain, their recommendations based upon the 4 categories, less than 1 week, 1 to 3, 3 to 6, or greater than 6 weeks, the recommendations were almost exactly the same throughout the entire spectrum of those. So there was no – they're basically showing that there was no benefit in, or no consideration. So I think literature saying that certainly less than 6 weeks is supported for treating these patients. And in my practice, I follow the UCLA RAND paper, and I was pretty much following that beforehand. But for my patients, I will treat patients in less than 6 weeks if they come to me and they have functional impairment and other criteria of the 7 clinical variables from that trial or from that paper. But one other thing I just wanted to talk about. Do you have a question?
So the more severe the symptoms and severe the disability, the sooner you'll do it and the less time you'll give to. It's kind of a
correct.
Sliding scale,
I mean,
in other words.
Right, and every patient has to have advanced imaging findings positive.
Okay.
Pain level. And then someone had mentioned that the previous studies didn't treat patients with mild pain, but I thought the inclusion criteria for at least the Buchbinder trial was for pain level greater than 3, which to me, if someone had less greater than 3 pain, I would be very cautious to treat them. In fact, I wouldn't.
Yeah.
Thank you, Lance. I don't think that's correct, Lance. I think you're mixing that up with the revised criteria for the INVEST trial. I think
the
Buchbinder.
Right, yeah, that's right. The INVEST I have in front of me is pain greater than or equal to 3, and it was up to 1 year for their inclusion criteria. So,
I think in general, though, most of them are moderate to severe. But anyway, did you have any other points? Because we probably have to move on. We have 4 more questions, and we've gone through half.
Well,
the time,
just a quick, because I was having some trouble getting in earlier, and we were talking about the first thing. I know that we seem like we're beating a dead horse talking about this, but when I read these questions in the CAC, it says over non-surgical management. And to me, non-surgical management, at least in my practice, if I'm evaluating a trial based upon what I can and cannot offer a patient, non-surgical management for me means doing nothing. So the results of Virtus 2, Faroki, and the Papanastasio Anderson meta-analyses are more relevant to me than the 2009 papers, which offer an alternative to vertebral augmentation that I cannot offer them. So, you know, from non-surgical management, my definition then, I guess, differs from what was actually tested in those 2009 papers.
Meaning the periosteal injection, is that what you're talking about?
Correct, because that is not a service I offer for the treatment of vertebral
right.
fractures.
And that was part of Vertos 4 also. So,
mm-hmm.
Do you think that should be offered prior to augmentation?
I haven't really thought about that. I think that it's something
that's what the Vertos 4 offer suggests.
Right. I mean, it's something that I have not thought about as offering in my practice. I mean, it's not
okay.
It's not how
okay.
I was trained.
All right. Let's move on. Operator, Dr. Beal is on again. Dr. Beal, time is getting short. Do you have a specific comment on the length of non-surgical management?
Yeah, I do have a specific comment, Dr. Hamm. So, again, the RAND criteria, we have expert recommendations, right? It's about the duration of pain, advanced imaging findings, the seven things that were mentioned. And they report in there, the experts recommend that duration of time is not important. I think what we deal with, the 6 to 8 weeks of non-surgical management, is just a meme that's been reported over and over again. There's no evidence for this. The evidence that does exist are by Kim and Bailey for bracing. So, you know, Dr. Kim at JBJS says, when compared no brace, soft brace, hard brace for 12 weeks, there was no difference in pain reduction. Dr. Bailey in Journal of Neurosurgery tested a brace or no brace for 8 weeks and a hyperacute fractures, meaning less than 72 hours. Again, no difference in pain reduction. Rezwuska did a meta-analysis in Eurospine, 5 studies that showed low quality of evidence for opioids, NSAIDs, or spinal braces. So there's any conclusion or insufficient data to recommend optimal conservative management for vertebral compression fractures. And this is the actual data, including meta-analysis that we have. One of the comments, Dr. Haug, about your periosteal injection bupivacaine, I mean, I guess it can be offered as a treatment, but this was offered and tested in the vapor trial. So in the vapor trial, specifically fractures less than 6 weeks, not 3 weeks, but 6 weeks. And I do have another comment that I won't make on the timing, but for paraspinal injection bupivacaine, the two adverse events in the augmentation for the vapor trial was one that was related to anesthesia and another one that was non-spine related. The two adverse events and the paraspinal injection of bupivacaine, one was turned out paraplegic because of cracked from anteroposterior and compressed the caudal quina. The other one required surgical decompression. So if we're going to inject with paraspinal bupivacaine, we at least have a level one paper that shows you need to be following these patients along, and presumably they were. One was paraplegic and the other one was required decompression. So this doesn't do anything to deal with the lack of structural integrity of the bone, which is pointed out as a primary principle of this. So if we do recommend something like this, we better be very cautious about doing that, just doing something to protect the structural integrity of the bone.
Right. Thank you, Dr. Beal. I don't think we have anybody else in the queue. I think we've covered this question fairly well. So why don't we go on to the next one? And this one is, I mean, those other two were more directed towards those folks who already believe that augmentation is valuable, and it was just when in vertebroplasty or kyphoplasty. But the next set of questions is for skeptics and advocates alike. So the first one is, what significant evidence gaps exist regarding the clinical criteria of individuals who should receive vertebral augmentation? And I guess let's start out here. There's been a few people have, I think, raised the question of whether our future studies comparing to a true sham, let's say, are even ethical. Dr. Hirsch, you want to kick that one off?
So just could you repeat the question, Greg, of whether or not it's ethical to do a sham trial?
I think it's been raised at this point whether that's even feasible.
Yes.
Whether ethical or whether just practical.
So
because patients won't accept it type of thing.
And that is a point that we hear commonly. I would say that I differ with many in my community. So again, stating my own personal bias, there is no question that it would be difficult to randomize patients who are in pain. And as our colleague from Endocrine spoke about earlier, there clearly is a selection bias for people who are in pain and have the opportunity to opt out. In Vapor, they did not, because essentially Medicare in Australia, whatever the Medicare equivalent is called, closed down access to vertebroplasty in the wake of the 2009 trials. I've argued for sham trials and have done that in writing and in many presentations, because I believe that there are obviously skeptics based on those trials that are out there. And Dr. Hogg actually was citing some work we did when he talked about the decline of the Medicare population in the wake of the trials being treated from 24% to 14%. While that has since risen, as a believer in augmentation, as a believer in the mortality benefit, it really bothers me that 80% of patients, some of them clearly having fractures that would potentially benefit from these procedures, are not being treated. And I think the way to get at that is to get past this issue of community equipoise. Now, there isn't really that much equipoise in the sense that people are debating internally whether they believe the procedure works. People generally are supporters or are not supporters. But in the community, think of it as a dumbbell type equipoise, something my friend Dave Kalmes talks about. We have proponents and people that are against the procedure. So for me, notwithstanding the challenges of doing the sham trials and notwithstanding the challenges of recruiting for those trials, I believe the way to actually increase the number of patients we're helping and therefore the mortality gains associated with the procedure is by proving the procedure against sham. I recognize that this is a difficult question, but in my mind it is therefore not unethical. I would now open it up to other subject matter experts who I'm certain will disagree.
Operator, can we get the next commenter?
Next question from line of Dr. John Barr.
Thank you. Actually, I've been waiting quite a while, so part of what I wanted to answer was probably almost an hour ago, there was an issue about new fractures. In fact, among the 15 reported trials, 11 did report on new fractures, and of those, 2 showed a statistically significant difference. The Farocchi trial said fractures were more common than the control group, and the Blasco trial said they were more common in the treatment arm. So I think we can conclude from this that there probably is no difference in the fracture rate, certainly in a negative fashion, from vertebral augmentation, either with vertebroplasty or kyphoplasty.
Do you have any comments regard to the current question as far as evidence gaps that exist?
I'm not convinced we have any significant evidence gaps. I also wanted to comment on the last question, which was the waiting period, and I'll be very quick with this. Clearly we have evidence that this doesn't cause fractures. We've heard fracture fixation is clearly the standard of care for weight-bearing bones. We have an excellent safety profile for augmentation. We have an unquestionable survival benefit. We have a benefit to decrease deformity and height maintenance with augmentation. Whether or not this truly has a durable result for pain, I think we have multiple factors that strongly argue for treatment, based on the patient's symptoms without some arbitrary waiting period. And in fact, the whole idea of the waiting period first entered the literature in the original long-expired now FDA guidance document, which has no listed authors, and there is not any reference prior to that in any medical literature that suggests that there is a reasonable rationale for a waiting period prior to intervention?
Dr. Bard, wasn't there, I think in the Virtus 2 study, didn't they do a extended length outcome where they found that most patients got better on their own, and so they made a case for waiting 6 weeks?
I think that may be correct, but that was long beyond the time when the procedure started to be popularized in North America, and decades beyond its application within Europe.
Okay. And what about the question about evidence gaps?
I'm not convinced we have serious evidence gaps. I think rather we have a very compelling body of evidence that there are numerous benefits to augmentation that are unquestionable. The only argument that may still be on the table is exactly what the role is in pain relief, the level of pain relief, the durability. But I think that's really a secondary issue to all the other evidence we have that's compelling that this is a highly beneficial procedure.
Okay. Thank you. Operator, next comment.
Your next question on the line of Dr. Deborah Tracy.
Yes, thank you, sir. I already introduced myself, so I won't do that again. I'm not sure I'm understanding the question, what significant evidence gaps do you mean in collecting data and patient selection? Is that what you're getting at in the clinical criteria?
Oh, that's the question. I mean, there's a lot of different aspects.
Okay. So I personally think, looking at all this literature, it's almost impossible to not have gaps. In patient selection, we have issues with time, with the architecture of the spine and the fracture, with the age of the patient, with the coexisting diseases, with the degree of osteoporosis. In imaging, we have, in the original studies, there were MRIs, there were x-rays, there were CT scans. There's different doctors choose different things. Some patients can't have an MRI because they have a pacemaker or a stimulator or some other cochlear implant or metal object. In the technique, I think that the dural puncture in the CalMe study was significant in that I think we watched the medial cortex of that procedure like a hawk, and anybody who would get a dural tear would be considered either inexperienced, rushed, or maybe negligent. So the technique also matters, and if there is extravasation of cement, is it causing other painful conditions and the evaluation of that? The statistical methods would be almost impossible for a medical doctor without a PhD in statistics to evaluate just from reading a paper, because we don't get all the data in the paper of the patient selection and different things that happen in the process. And in terms of survival, I would like to point you towards the documentation by Edidin, who did a claims-based study and found dramatic difference between conservative therapy and cement augmentation, and Zampini, who also found a dramatic a difference between those who went home early and stayed, and mortality and other things, including cost. I would also like to say that, in my opinion, it is absolutely unethical to not provide this procedure. I mean, and in terms of time, I see people in the hospital who are one day after a fall. They can't move. They're flat on their back. They have a bedpan underneath them. They have a Foley catheter in place. They're tachycardic. They're hypertensive. Mm-hmm. And there's no way, even one day after the fall, that I would say no, conservative therapy would be the way to go. And they can't tolerate it. Brace.
So are you in the further studies would be an ethical camp?
Yes.
Okay. Okay, thank you. Operator,
thank
next
you.
Commenter.
Your next question line of Dr. Christopher Meyer.
Yes, hi. I'm Chris Meyer. I'm a CAC representative for the Wisconsin Radiology Society, and I have no conflicts. And I just wanted to make a comment sort of to tie into the last person's comments with regard to the reduction in mortality as probably being a stronger argument for vertebroplasty and vertebral augmentation versus conservative therapy. I'm a chest radiologist, so, you know, I'm more familiar with screening studies and LST, and certainly when we look at randomized controlled trials, we're concerned about mortality reductions, and it's my understanding that there's at least four good studies out there, two by Edman and one by Lang and one by Lin, looking at mortality reduction, and I'm happy to then listen to other people's comments. Thank you.
So if I could just ask, which camp are you in? Further studies are needed or would be contraindicated?
I don't honestly, I don't know that I have an opinion about that. I think that from what I've seen so far or from what I've heard so far, I don't think that we need to do additional studies.
Dr. Hogg, this is Josh. I'd just like to make a quick comment.
Yeah.
The largest publication demonstrating a mortality advantage is one where I served as the senior author. I'm very proud of that effort. So I just want to repeat why I think it is ethical in that context, and I understand that I am subject to criticism for this belief, but why I believe that it is ethical to do these types of trials, because I don't think there is any chance that we will convince a sizable group of referring clinicians about the benefits that Dr. Tracy, yourself, and many others have described, absent demonstrating that in sham-based trials. And so if we think about the mortality advantage across a population versus on that individual patient, which is a very difficult argument to make, the greater benefit will be derived from proving to those skeptics that what we believe to be the case is true. I'll just make my comment end at that point. I know there are other people lined up to speak.
Yeah, and let me just ask a question, because this is coming up in my mind more and more when what would seemingly be landmark studies come up, not just in this area, but other areas. If it goes against, especially if the procedure is already out there and widespread, it seems like it's impossible for the study to ever be good enough to not be criticized and basically ignored. So that would be the other argument, besides the ethics and the practicalities of patient agreeing, with whether a study could ever be good enough to withstand the slings and arrows of entrenched belief. Dr. Hirsch?
If you're posing that to me, well, I mean, I think the challenge is that it's not just belief, though it's characterized as belief. In the sense that the proponents of the trial are either the patients, the patient advocates, or the providers that have done the procedures and seen the remarkable benefit associated with it. And versus other, the sort of more general question of, if you have a trial that demonstrates, for example, a medication doesn't work that is already in common usage. This wouldn't occur, but I'm trying to get away from a procedure. So in this imagined state, where there are reasonable or meaningful alternatives, one could imagine a practice change. What we saw in 2009 was that the patients that were not referred in after the trials came in 6 months later more debilitated. And so I think that the proponents of the procedure are basing their opinions not just on belief or this type of anecdotal approach, but from the, I would call it, real-world evidence of what the conservative therapy cohort does. And conservative therapy is a real therapy. It was characterized earlier as doing nothing. That's not correct. The adverse consequences of conservative therapy and augmentation, and I do believe these are some of the reasons we saw the mortality benefit. It's clear that the trials are an uphill battle, both to get done, but also to have widespread belief in them. But again, I do think, really, as far back as our introductory comments, in this particular situation, there's really compelling data on that different people can take different things from, and therefore, whether you're arguing for the procedure or against it, there really is strong data on both sides. The preponderance of the data is supportive of the procedure, the vast predominance, but the few sham trials have obviously really thrown a chink in that armor. Again, for me, and this may be a largely theoretical comment, I'm disturbed by the 80% of patients that are not treated. And I think a lot of that is coming from the fact that there is this really bifurcated belief system in the value and reasonability even of offering these procedures. And if we ever really want to get at that group that, in my opinion, is suffering unnecessarily, we're going to need to convince the referring community, the members that don't believe in the procedure right now. I'm confident that if we were to see that, there would be that type of reaction.
Thank you. Operator, if we could have the next commenter.
Your next question line of Dr. Melissa Chambers.
Go ahead, Dr.
Yes, this is right. Thanks. This is Renee Chambers again. I have just a quick comment about this very fact. And when Dr. Hirsch began by discussing equipoise, Josh, I'll take your theoretical comment and Trump with a philosophical comment. The state of genuine uncertainty on the part of clinical investigators would make clinical trials difficult from a practical standpoint. However, even though there will be questions about the ethics, I think it would be ethical to go forward with clinical trials. I think they're feasible. I think the fact that emotions oftentimes overshadow facts can be overcome with clinical trials. And there was a publication probably 30 years ago in the New England Journal about clinical equipoise. And that stated that the requirement of equipoise is satisfied when there is a genuine uncertainty within the expert medical community, not just on the part of the individual investigators. So for that reason, I think there is clinical equipoise. So clinical trials are appropriate if they would not preclude ongoing care to those select patients in need of vertebral augmentation in order to reduce their morbidity and risk of mortality. That's all
I have. Thank you. Operator, next commenter.
Your next question was line of Dr. John Barr.
Go ahead, Dr.
Barr. Yeah, actually, many of my comments have been made by others already, but my feeling is that it would be of questionable ethics given the very well demonstrated repeatedly survival benefit to augmentation to run further trials. On that point alone.
Thank you. Operator, next commenter.
Your next question comes from the line of Dr. Douglas Beal.
Hey there, Doug Beal again. Comment about the ethical nature of this. I'm going to respectfully with a qualified disagreement, disagree with Dr. Hirsch. So I think this is unethical to do this. the proviso on that is only in a very ethical way. Let me tell you why. This is a nod out to our endocrine, rheumatology, and internal medicine docs. The treatment for osteoporosis and the underlying disorder in a meta-analysis by Bolland, 2011, for antiresorptive, said that you have a mortality reduction of 11%. So one of the reasons we don't do comparative placebo-controlled trials in anti-osteoporotic medications in the United States primarily is because of that. That was followed by a debate in the New England Journal between Stein and Ray that said, if we know something is effective, we shouldn't be using a placebo. And they cited the Helsinki Doctrine that reinforces longstanding prohibition against offering placebo instead of something that's known to be effective. So I buy that, and I sign off on that. And the most recent article is referred to previously, it published this last year, in Ong et al., and Josh was on the last author on that. I was the second author on that trial. And instead of an 11% reduction in mortality, we reported that vertebroplasty had a 24% reduction in mortality and kyphoplasty had a 55% reduction in mortality. So kind of by definition, that may be unethical. But to solve, if there's significant controversy in the physician population about whether or not this is effective or not, the qualified portion of that would be that it could be ethical under certain circumstances. For example, a short-term crossover, a very controlled trial, a small number of sites participating with very supervised non-surgical management. So that may, but in general, because of these, because of the Helsinki Doctrine and the presence of something that has been shown to be effective, I think this is unethical. And in regard to something that's good enough to withstand entrenched beliefs, we could talk about randomized controlled trials, placebo-controlled trials, et cetera, but we do have a registry. It's 1,096 patients total, of which 732 patients have six-month follow-up data that I referenced earlier as dramatic pain reduction, 6.7-point reduction in pain and a Roland Morris disability that went from severely disabled to mild from a 21 to a 7. So I think in the absence of something that's beyond criticism, real-world data would have to supplant that.
Thanks, Dr. Beal. Let's move on. We have three more questions and about 45 minutes. So now, though I think as we go on, there may be some – these questions will prompt some or have already been partially answered. So I would just ask people if, you know, to – not bring up things that we've already hashed through before. But getting to the next question, you know, and it relates to what we were just talking about, what types of information are there? There's not just randomized controlled trials. And actually one of the voting questions related to what other types of information would be warranted, blinded randomized trials, non-blinded observational, propensity-adjusted claims-based data, systematic reviews, registries, as was just mentioned. But this next question relates to the claims-based data, which is another way to go about trying to answer the question that sidesteps, I think, the ethics practicality issues we were just talking about. So the question is, how important do you consider the claims-based data, which suggests that kyphoplasty and vertebroplasty have a mortality advantage over non-surgical management? And I mentioned in my intro that and this is Dr. Hirsch's, who was a senior author on this paper, they found a 4% increase in propensity-adjusted mortality risk associated with the drop in utilization after the 2009 studies. Dr. Hirsch, you want to lead that one off since
sure.
So to speak?
well, my elderly osteoporotic baby. I think that Dr. Hogg cites a point we made in the paper. I would cite a different one, which is actually something Dr. Beal just mentioned. Using this analysis at multiple time points, in fact at every time point, there were very substantial mortality benefits of augmentation over non-surgical management. And this was looking at 2 million patients with osteoporotic vertebral compression fractures over 10 years from the fee-for-service Medicare database. What I would say to me the striking point was that at 1 year, the mortality difference was 55% between kyphoplasty and non-surgical management, which was the most dramatic finding. This corroborates almost every claims-based study from multiple databases and actually multiple countries. There's a single study done in the United States, actually friends of mine, or at least a senior author is a friend of mine, where they found the same finding but applied propensity score matching and on that basis excluded the data. However, I would without getting into a critique of that technique, suggest that to argue that there isn't a signal from the multiple other papers, including papers that looked at morbidity and mortality, including papers that had propensity score matching, would be disingenuous. In the same way, I argue that one should try to glean important findings from trials that maybe one doesn't agree with the findings. So to me, that mortality benefit has been very meaningful, and it has impacted my specific procedural choice. And I believe that it is, at this point, having looked at such a large data set, and I think this has been seen on this call, well established as part of the discussion. I would say that there are two theoretical reasons that I think this mortality relationship exists. The first is conservative management is not risk-free management. And while we can talk about paralysis and other things that occur with worsening compression fractures, in reality, patients who are getting conservative management are put at less activity, are put on opioids frequently, actually. There's little question in my mind that these interventions are not necessarily as good as mobilizing someone quickly. The second thing I would say, this was alluded to by different speakers, there are now two studies, Virtus 4 and Vapor, that looked at patients longer term and did serial x-rays. And I would correct an earlier statement that there is no loss of height after augmentation. I would say there is a far less substantial loss of height in augmented patients. And when we think about the natural history of this disease and how people get multiple VCFs, it's pretty clear, I think, that as you add up fracture after fracture, height loss after height loss from untreated vertebrae, this could also contribute to the mortality findings that we saw. So Dr. Haug was kind enough to let me speak about something I feel strongly about. I admit I'm biased, but I consider this claims-based data to be very important, and it guides my thinking on a lot of the questions here. I think we should open up to other subject matter experts.
Thank you. Operator, next commenter.
Next question will come from Dr. Deborah Tracy.
Oh, thank you again. Thank you for tolerating me here. I'm so grateful that you've opened this up nationally. I don't think it's ever been done before. But for those of us on the call who don't have a lot of background in this, I would like to point to Edidin, who is one of the authors in the domain of literature we were provided, who in 2013 did a study called The Life Expectancy Following Diagnosis of Vertebral Compression Fractures in the Osteoporosis International Journal. He took 858,978 claims. He found that he studied cement augmentation to conservative treatment. The kyphoplasties in the study were 119,000, and the vertebroplasties were 63,000. And the adjusted life expectancy was 85% greater for those that received the cement augmentation than those that did not. The kyphoplasty in this study had a 34% greater adjusted life expectancy than the vertebroplasty. Now, Zampini's claims-based study, and we're talking about claims-based, is not in the domain of this literature, but Zampini, let me get that here, did a study of 5,766 patients in February of 2010. He found discharge to home in the operative group was 38% and discharge to home in the non-operative group was 21%. He found discharge to skilled nursing in the operative group was 26% and in the non-operative it was 34%. Discharge to facility was 35% in the operative group and 47%. Mortality in the operative group was 0.3% and in the other group was 1.6%. And the cost was greater, of course, for the kyphoplasty group of $37,000 compared to the in-hospital cost of the non-treated patients of $20,000. So I personally am very impressed by the claims-based literature. And to provide this type of study costs tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands in servers and acquiring the claims, the Medicare claims-based data. Also, the National Institute of Healthcare Excellence in the United Kingdom did their own claims-based study and found that cement augmentation was an appropriate intervention for people with unhealed osteoporotic compression fractures in whom pain is severe and ongoing. And you can see the compression fracture definitely causes architectural changes in the spine. We know that. So further pain could also be caused by reflex muscle spasm or other conditions that I stated earlier. And thank you very much.
Thank you. Operator, next commenter, please.
Next question line of Dr. Douglas Bill.
Thank you.
So
in regard to the claims-based analysis, it was overwhelming data. Edmund had two papers, 858,000 was mentioned. The other one was over a million, it was 1,038,000. Pursuant to the article that was written, referred to previously by Dr. Hirsch, is that it examined the downward trend in treatment after the 2009 New England Journal articles. And the upshot of that was it put 75,000 people at increased risk of life lost, and statistically at least, demonstrably 6,800 people lost their lives because of the downward trend in treatment. So this is incredibly important. I would also, somebody referenced the McCullough article previously. I would also caution a broad interpretation of this without actually reading the paper. They did propensity score matching, and they did it at short-term and long-term. At a month and a year, and found out of three out of the four time points measured, there was a statistically significant reduction in mortality. The only one that wasn't statistically significant was the patients at 1 year that were treated with fibroplasty, but the p-value is 0.18. And if you take all of the patients, and they culled out 71% of the patients, if you take all the patients in that data set, you do a propensity score matching on it, as was done in the Ong paper with the propensity score match, you get a huge reduction in mortality. So you have to really qualify that before you say there's no reduction in mortality whenever three out of your time points state that there was a significant reduction. The fourth one is 0.18. And all of the rest of them, Zampini, Chen, Edmonds, both papers, There's papers from Ansgar Lang. There's this Casper has a paper. There's papers from Hong Kong, from China, from all over the world, as was previously. So the claims-based analysis at the very basis is consistent, and I think certainly cannot be ignored.
That's real. How would you compare or think of the registry information versus claims-based data?
Well, registry, so claims-based analysis, we do Kaplan-Meier for survival, Cox regression for mortality. The way that the registry was done is not claims-based. In fact, the way that this registry was done in the United States registry, it was done according to the Meridian criteria, because this was originally the inception of this. This was done as a request from the Meridian region for Medicare. And so what was done is specifically the LCD, the inclusion-exclusion criteria for treating patients with vertebral augmentation, the LCD for Noridian was used for this.
So this is not only real-world data. This is done with Medicare patients. This is done under Medicare criteria using the specific LCD. And so I would contrast that dramatically. I mean, this is as real-world gets for the U.S. Registry. It was sponsored by Society, by the way. And this contrasts that between the claims-based analysis that specifically studied morbidity and mortality, not only mortality, but statistically significant reductions in morbidity as well for most of these patients, most of these papers.
Thank you. Okay. Let's move on to the next question. I don't think anybody else is in the queue. And again, this may be one that we've touched on in prior discussions. Is vertebral augmentation indicated for patients requiring hospitalization for pain management? Operator, can you see if there's any comments on that question?
At this time, if you would like to ask a question, please press star, then your number one on your telephone keypad. Again, that's star, then your number one to ask a question. We'll pause for just a moment to compile the Q&A roster.
Because pausing causes me pain, let me go ahead and make a quick comment here. I think that the hospitalized patient does represent a different population in the sense that one can argue that they are already potentially far along the pathway of failing conservative therapy. So in my outpatient practice, I have more extensive discussions about conservative therapy than in patients that have already been admitted to the hospital with pain. I think that's likely true across much of the country, and this is I think consistent with Medicare efforts and multiple efforts to try to move patients out of inpatient high acuity areas as quickly as is medically safe and reasonably possible.
And also decreasing the use of opioids.
Yes.
Thank you. Operator, can we have the first commenter?
Your first question comes from the line of Dr. Jeffrey Koh.
Dr. Koh? Dr. Koh, your line is open if you can hear us. Are you on mute, perhaps? If not,
okay. I'm sorry, I was on mute. Sorry, I'm here now. Can you hear me?
Okay. Yes, we can hear you.
I'm sorry.
It's a common thing.
I'm sorry. Orthopedic surgeon, California CAC. This subset of patient represents the patients that will benefit from the most from this. These are equivalent to the unstable hip fractures that require medical stabilization. In painting, it's actually, in many ways, a more expeditious and simple procedure to perform. These patients, I think, probably if you would extract these patients out of the, Dr. Beal's registry or the other trials that show the increased mortality, these are probably the single subgroup that have the greatest advantage. And so perhaps not without any exception, but as a rule and with rare exception that these patients most likely would benefit from vertebral augmentation, assuming the diagnosis is correct. The issue is, many of these patients get admitted for treatment of back pain, and unfortunately, the hospitalists perhaps don't make the appropriate diagnoses or delay in getting the MRI, radiographs, and the like. So it's a question of education and perhaps convincing those that this is a real benefit to these patients. And I'm going to also speak back to the ethics of, if you don't mind, the ethics of performing a randomized controlled trial again, despite recognizing there's a mortality benefit. Even if you could ethically perform such a trial and you thought that having a few patients die would benefit the larger patients that would die because you haven't convinced the referral base, you still have to counsel the patients and their families that if you enroll in this trial, that there is prevailing evidence that there is a higher mortality if you are randomized to the control group. And if you do that, you're not going to have good patient selection. So it's a catch-22. That kind of trial will be impossible to perform ethically. I'm done. Thank you.
Dr. Hirsch, it sounds like you're being hoisted on your own petard.
Yes, I mean, I acknowledge that people will disagree with my my point of view on this, and certainly I do believe that there are serious questions about mortality benefit of the patient in front of you versus societal. I stand by my comments, and I understand that they're subject to criticism. I will say that trials could consider, as was mentioned by other speakers, short durations with crossover that would mitigate the mortality concerns, but we don't know when that mortality risk begins. And you know, I'm prepared for different people of good intentions and faith to simply disagree on this point.
Operator, the next commenter, please.
Next question of line of Dr. Douglas Beal.
Dr. Beal.
Just a short comment on this. The concept about treating acute or hospitalized patients, so this was studied, of course, in Yang and Bill Clark's VAPOR trial. The VAPOR study said they were older, had a high intensity pain score, higher than the rest of the other sham trials, and they were they had been hospitalized before, and it reported a greater amount of outcome and improvement, of course, because the higher the pain score, the greater the improvement after the patient's improved. But this has been documented, I think, not only the VAPOR trial, but also Yang, the vertebroplasty versus non-surgical management randomized control trial published just recently.
Thank you. Operator, do we have any other questions?
Again, if you would like to ask a question, please press star, then your number one on your telephone keypad. Again, that's star, then your number one to ask a question. And your next question in line of Dr. John Jordan.
Yes, Dr. John Jordan from Los Angeles area, representing Providence, a little company of Mary Medical Center in Torrance, and also the chair of the Standards and Guidelines Committee for the American Society of Neuroradiology. Yeah, just a brief comment on hospitalization. I agree with Josh at this and others that this is a special group of patients that we're talking about. I think in terms of the clinical management, the benefits are somewhat evident, but also the very significant economic benefits. And I think we've all seen cases where patients have been not treated and let go only to return to the emergency room and be rehospitalized again. So obviously you get into you know, significant diminishing returns from a financial point of view in not treating these patients sooner than later. I think also the evidence that was pointed out earlier in terms of the mortality benefits speaks strongly to treating these patients while they're admitted. And then finally, the other issues, hospital-acquired pneumonias, and et cetera, other things that occur when patients are hospitalized for a prolonged period of time would also be mitigated by treatment. That's all I have.
Thank you. Okay, I don't see anybody else in queue, so let's move to the final question. Are more trials on exercise or rehabilitation interventions needed, and will they be done? Operator, can you see if anybody wants to comment on that question?
At this time, if you would like to ask a question, please press star, then your number one on your telephone keypad. Your next question line of Dr. Douglas Beal.
No, I agree with the other speakers that this is all the non-surgical management trials, rehab trials, these are replete in the literature. I mean, there are 250 articles a year. There's last meta-analysis was 1,587 articles in the English language, and many of these use this as a comparator. So I don't really think that this needs to be examined any further. We do know the relative rate of mortality. Somebody that has a spine fracture is 8.6 times age-matched controls. That comes from a Colley's FIT trial. So this is something that's known. People have a known increased morbidity, mortality. We know that by treating them, we reduce their morbidity, mortality. In terms of optimal non-surgical management, I just gave you articles by Bailey and Kim and Rezwuska that says there's really no benefit to doing this. I think the only literature gap there potentially may be
optimal non-surgical management for patients that have low to moderate pain that are getting better. Non-surgical management is very appropriately applied to patients, and this is based on the appropriateness criteria, UCLA RAND appropriateness paper. If people have low to moderate pain or the symptoms are getting better, if they have moderate to severe pain or their symptoms are getting worse, one of the seven things were mentioned previously, they should go on to treatment regardless of time. So I think the data is replete in this regard, and the only potential improvement would be in the refinements of the patients that could tolerate non-surgical management.
Thank you. Operator, next commenter.
Your next question line of Dr. Deborah Tracy.
Thank you again. I would have to compliment Dr. Jordan. I was to a lecture given by the Providence Group, and they have very high MIP scores. They focus intently on quality, and for Dr. Jordan to say that this is a cost and a quality issue, I think has great impact. I would also like to say the question prior to this about hospitalization, when a patient requires hospitalization for a fracture, if their pain is from the fracture, they often have other comorbidities like CHF, renal failure, severe osteoporosis from their autoimmune diseases, lymphoma, myeloma, multiple myeloma, and so they should absolutely be considered candidates for kyphoplasty, vertebroplasty. In terms of exercise, I personally, and this has nothing to do with the literature, find it a contradiction in terms to ask someone who has a fracture to exercise, and I've seen many patients from acute care rehab hospitals fail that modality and return to the hospital, as one of the other doctors suggested, as a readmission, which is a no-no in this day and age, for treatment of their bone fracture. Thank you.
Thank you. Dr. Hirsch, do you have anything to add here? I don't think anybody else is in the queue right now.
You know, I can just add my experience because I don't consider myself an expert in rehab. What I have clinically employed is physical therapy after the patient returns from for their follow-up visit when I think that would be helpful. In my experience, the physical therapy that people are able to participate in when they're acutely suffering from a fracture is really quite limited, and it has more to do with range of motion, et cetera. That doesn't mean it shouldn't be studied, because I think any time we can optimize ancillary or alternative therapies, that is worth doing. So I think there are probably opportunities there, but I would defer to people who are more expert than me on what they are.
Thank you. We don't have anybody else in the queue right now, so I'm going to reach out actually to my fellow CMDs. I asked them to hold back to allow the maximum time for the experts to weigh in. But since we have a few minutes here at the end, I'm just going to ask them, are there any of them that want to ask a question or make a comment? Eileen, are you out there?
I am out here. So one of the thoughts that occurred to me is, and after
listening, you're a medical director for Noridian, and you're
oh,
a.
Oh, sorry. My background is one of those rheumatologists. So one of the things I experienced in practice was a very difficult time getting medication for some of these folks in terms of drugs like Forteo. It's almost impossible. How much do you think the difficulty in getting some of those things for this group plays into the fact that treating them surgically becomes more of an issue?
I'll start that off, but I know we have other endocrine and rheumatology type folks on the phone. I didn't catch your name, so I'll just call you Carrier Medical Director
for Moynihan. Dr. Moynihan.
Thank you, Dr. Moynihan. Thank you, Dr. Hogg. Dr. Moynihan, I think that there is no question that there's a terrible scourge of osteoporosis, and the access to expensive medications isn't the only issue. My own mother took herself off bisphosphonates without telling me, and she's a slight Caucasian woman, really a setup for a fracture because she kept hearing about avascular necrosis of the jaw on TV. I think we have a terrible public health crisis related to osteoporosis. I mean, absolutely terrible. And I think that when I talk to patients about vertebral augmentation, I will not talk to them about it without being in context of osteoporosis medication. And what I always say is that I'm a cheerleader. I don't manage osteoporosis, but I've worked very hard to develop collaborative practices at various institutions with endocrine and in our institution now also rheumatology to optimize management, because what I say to the patients is vertebral augmentation is the battle, but the war is osteoporosis. In a perfect world, if people were getting the proper medication for these fractures, I think we would conceivably have less requirement for treating these painful VCFs, but I feel like we're probably a long way from that. I will say that people that have osteoporosis and a fracture really are likely to be suffering from pretty dramatic osteoporosis, and they should qualify for aggressive therapy with osteoporosis medication.
Agreed. Easy to agree, but difficult to execute. Thanks.
Dr. Clark.
Yes, Larry Clark, NGS, internal medicine, and co-worker with Dr. Haug, who did a great job putting this panel together, and thank you to everybody. I found Dr. Tracy very compelling. She really recalled my time working as a medical consultant on a rehab unit, and her stratification and portrayal of the patients with the comorbidities on the bisphosphonates taking opiates. And really, I need to walk away from this reviewing the mortality data in light of her comments. One of the things that I would like to do, I've heard Dr. Beal go back to about three or four papers, Edmonds, Ong, the bookbinder study, that's the Australian study, and review some of these implications again. And I think what I want to do is look at some of the findings, particularly the mortality findings, in light of Dr. Tracy's comments and the comorbidities that contributed to that patient data. So anyway, but thank you, everybody.
Thanks, Dr. Clark. Any of the other CMDs out there want to make a comment or ask a question of our experts?
Yes, I do. Craig, Steve Bourne here.
Dr. Bourne, yes.
Why don't
you introduce yourself?
Oh, yes. My name is Steve Bourne. I'm one of the NGS medicals who work with Dr. Haug and Dr. Clark. The point I want to bring up is a number of people have mentioned the various costs. It's illegal for Medicare to use cost in making coverage decisions.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Any other comments from CMDs? Dr. Lurvy, introduce yourself.
Okay, I'm Art Lurvy. I'm a contractor medical director on the West Coast with Noridian. And I want to thank the subject experts. We are all aware that the literature per se is mixed, and we appreciate those who've worked on the studies and those who are deeply involved in understanding the statistics to be able to help us understand which of the studies seem to be better than the other studies and understand some of the problems with the studies. So I really want to thank the subject matter experts.
Yeah, and did you mention your specialty?
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm a board-certified endocrinologist.
Thank you. And there was somebody else who chimed in there along with Dr. Lurby.
Yeah, Craig, this is Sydney Hayes from Novitas. And I'm a pulmonologist, and I would agree that all patients are not alike and that sometimes time is of the essence when you are pushing steroids and other drugs for fibrosis and so forth, and the collapse starts, and it usually is more than just one vertebrae, and often once they go to bed and you cannot get them up to cough, clear their secretions, it is a death spiral. So I'm not sure that waiting 6 weeks would ever be appropriate for those patients, and I do appreciate all the subject matter experts and their input today. Thank you.
Thank you. Anybody else from the CMD side?
Greg, could I just make a comment to one of your colleagues? I really appreciate the point made about Medicare not relying on or not being allowed to utilize cost-effectiveness data. I would make the following two points. I believe in alternative payment models of the future, vertebral augmentation is going to actually be widely utilized, because I do believe that when one compares it to the expenses that incur directly as well as the indirect expenses of the people becoming much less active, across networks and across alternative payment models, we'll see an appreciation of the benefits of the early mobilization, diminution of medication, not needing braces, etc. The second point I wanted to make is that the NICE is not limited. The NICE of the NHS is not limited in the way PCORI or Medicare is. They are, as part of their protocol, thinking about cost-effectiveness. And I don't remember for sure, but I think it was Dr. Tracy from Florida who earlier referenced the NICE guidance, which their first page of guidance is that inappropriate patients for vertebral augmentation should be offered. And again, I'm only making this point because they absolutely consider cost-effectiveness in their recommendations.
Thank you. Any other CMDs want to either ask a question of our experts while we have them or make a comment? If not, operator, I think Dr. Beal wants to weigh in again.
Dr. Beal, your line is open.
Thanks. Just one comment about the treatment of osteoporosis. So I'm a treater of vertebral compression fractures, and I do large number of vertebral fractures. I also treat patients' underlying disorder. And I'll disagree just a little bit with the contractor medical director of Novitas, and I think she'll appreciate this agreement, that I don't quite think it's that hard to get approval for anabolics. Thankfully, I usually start off with those for people that are the typical patients that have severe osteoporosis and followed up by anteresorptive therapy and see them throughout their whole course. I mean, and the treatment for vertebral compression fractures is no substitute for treatment of the underlying disorders. And for my colleagues that don't treat the underlying disorder, I would encourage you to do so. We definitely have a treatment gap that's there. And treatment of with vertebral augmentation does not mean the treatment for the underlying disorder that caused that fracture shouldn't be pursued. And so it's a little bit of an editorial comment, but I do find that it's effective, that it's not that difficult, that provides good, sustainable, and many times a whole life duration treatment effect on people that treat their underlying disorder, even after you've treated them with augmentation.
Thank you. Operator, if you could open the next commenter, but I want to ask him a question before.
Your next question line of Dr. David Epstein.
Dr. Epstein,
yes,
I don't have you on my.
Ahead. That's fine.
Yeah, I don't have you on my list though. Are you a CAC member?
Yes, Florida CAC, 20 years.
Okay.
No, financial disclosure. Did someone else want to make a comment first? Sorry.
No, but if you could send us your disclosure form after the meeting, I'd appreciate it. But go ahead.
Actually, it was already sent in. They received it.
Okay.
So, actually, just I'm an interventional radiologist in the Fort Lauderdale area. I've been doing initially vertebroplasty, then kyphoplasty for 15, 20 years. The vast majority of our practice is inpatient. We get a small number, maybe 10% at the most, that comes through our clinical office, but most of these are patients who have come through the ED, typically. And I have always been very much in favor of the rapid treatment side. I see what happens when these patients sit in bed, and particularly the ones who we have been consulting on after 4 or 5 days in the hospital. My sense of a treatment failure, a conservative treatment failure, is an 80-year-old who's got in bed, no movement facility, and has gotten one Percocet. I consider that a treatment failure, even if it's the first day. As far as the pain level cutoff, I don't use a scale. I just look at someone, and once in a while this happens even on the inpatient side. Someone, an 80-year-old, 100-year-old, we've done 105-year-olds, if they can get out of their bed faster than I can, then I don't think they need the procedure. But I do have a question about what data I would be interested to see. Now, this may already exist. I haven't seen it. Maybe Dr. Beal has, is that we do see on occasion, sometimes we have some hair trigger docs in the ER or the hospitalist, and we'll get a patient who has a fall of variable severity, has some pain, they get a scan, and we see on MR only a T2 signal in a vertebral body indicating an acute fracture, but there's no compression. And let's say that their pain is not severe. So, therefore, we really don't have great criteria to treat that, but I would be interested if there is or could be obtained the data that shows what the natural course of these fractures that are only visible on MR, so we don't have 50 years worth of data on these, what the natural course of untreated, non-compressed vertebral fractures, particularly in the lumbar spine.
Dr. Hirsch, did you want to address that?
Yeah, it sounded like Dr. Epstein was specifically asking Dr. Beal. I would just say this is straightforward. If a person has limited symptoms, I think that independent of the MRI, I would recommend managing them conservatively and see how they're doing. And I think that would be the general guidance that one would get on most fronts, including the much referenced RAND study that included the multiple different people. I think the amount of height loss is not significant relative to the degree of pain the patient's in, but the situation that you describe where the person is getting a scan because the person is trigger happy, there's a finding, I would absolutely not advocate treating that patient.
Well, these are patients who actually probably do have pain, who may have had pain relevant to the fracture. But and again, we're not currently treating these if they have insufficient pain. Let's say no pain. But the question was really just going forward, is anyone, because I get asked this by the referring doctors, if you don't treat it?
Mm-hmm. Dr. Epstein, yeah. Dr. Beal is back in the queue, so it sounded like you were asking. We're coming up really to the 4 o'clock mark. So we got two people in the queue. If both could keep their comments pretty short.
Okay.
Operator, can you open Dr. Beal?
Thank you. This has been described before. There's a good article by Weishaupt that I can send you that goes along where somebody has increased stir signal or fluid sensitive signal but does not hurt. There's exactly the opposite that's been described in the same article. There's another provisional set of data that says the patient has severe pain but the fracture is not seen hyperacutely but is seen acutely, meaning more than 1 week. So the synthesis of this is to, based on what we know, based on what's been described, just treat it symptomatically. And these can be seen. Whenever we think we know everything there is to know about vertebral fractures, I mean, these are some of the outliers. But this it has been described before, and the treatment is short-term follow-up, meaning 2 weeks, and observation if they don't have very much pain.
Thank you. Operator, next commenter. And again, Dr. Tracy, go ahead.
Thank you. I wanted to thank the medical director who complimented me, number one, and I wanted to state that when he does go back I did comment on the Butchbinder study, but I didn't comment on the Calme study, that when he does go back to that study to focus on the fact that 1,813 patients were screened and the enrollment was 131, took 4 years, less than half of what their target was, which they abandoned after the 4 years. And that for 80% power, each group which should have had 133 participants and not 60-plus as they did have, that they accrued patients that were 27 to 52 weeks out from their fracture, and that their imaging was inconsistent. In other words, what Dr. Beal and other physicians have pointed out about edema in the marrow, if you do an X-ray, you have no idea what the age of the fracture is, and they had X-ray, CT scans, and MRIs. And that the sham procedure, finally, osseous injection, is not is considered a treatment, actually, and that's what they used against the cement augmentation. Thank you.
Thank you. All right. Well, it looks like we're coming up to the 4 o'clock mark. I don't see anybody else in the queue. Are the CMDs any other last-minute comments or questions? Okay. Dr. Hirsch, any concluding thoughts?
Yes, you know, Greg, I really appreciate the opportunity to co-moderate, and I just want to thank, given the very strong feelings people have on both sides of this topic, the thoughtfulness and sensitivity of the comments we received and the really high-level, civilized nature of the discussion. So I just want to nod appreciation to all those that were brave enough to make comments, and thank the carrier medical directors, and in particular you, Dr. Haug, for making this discussion possible.
Thank you, and a special thanks to you as well for co-moderating and acting the honest broker. I know it couldn't have been easy, so thanks very much for that. I think it added a lot. And so just before closing, I'd like to say that the meeting transcript and audio recording will be published on HMAC's website in probably about a week, I think, and the voting results probably the week after. Remember, only the aggregate, not individual scores, will be published. To have your votes count, please return them. I'm going to say in 1 week, March 27th, although I would urge people to use the Excel spreadsheet. That will make things a lot easier for us and probably more accurate. Again, if we have to transcribe from some written documents, especially if they're sent in, that will delay things and also make it probably less accurate. So from a variety of standpoints, I would really strongly urge people to use that Excel spreadsheet to put your votes. Again, it wasn't meant to put responses to the discussion questions. It was purely meant to log your votes, and that'll go a long way to speeding things up and making it more accurate. I'm sure I speak for all the MACs and the CMDs in appreciation for everyone's participation in today's CAC. It provided invaluable perspectives and information that will surely inform our future policy. And again, I've already said special thanks to Dr. Hirsch again for acting the honest broker. Otherwise, thanks again to everybody, and have a good evening.
This concludes today's conference call. You may now disconnect at this time.